Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and this week we're going to be digging into multi-classing, dual-classing, and level limits in across the editions of D&D. I mean, is it a good idea to mix and match classes like that? You know, were the level limits in early D&D ever a good rule? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the discussion, I'll remind everyone, as always, that at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our After Party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host with all of our lovely patrons, and we'd love for you to join them. You could do so by visiting our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms and join at any tier level, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Hit that link, get your account all set up, and maybe about 10 minutes to 15 minutes after the show, we will be there to talk to you all live.
Paul, we just have the best patrons. I enjoy talking to them after the show individually so much. For example, Backweus checking in that we're currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restreambot is great. And also, we haven't even started the show, and I'm seeing people like Nathan saying, I got some cold hard data queued up for this episode. And that is what DM's patrons are all about. Well done, sir.
Definitely really enjoy getting in there and chatting with everybody. And it's always a good, lively conversation. So please do come and join us. And frankly, a source of our inspiration for a lot of our shows, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Springboards into new shows frequently, which is fantastic. So I was thinking about, I was doing some analysis on XP advancement in classic D&D and how fast it happens and things like that. So I was looking closely at the XP charts in recent weeks this summer. And I was also thinking when we were playing through Skull Mountain back at the beginning of July with you as DM and me, one of the players, there was a point where one of the players had a little bit of grief feeling that he was disadvantaged at playing basically original D&D or a mashup of Moldvay Basic he had a single classed wizard, and mm-hmm. there came a point where he felt that he was disadvantaged at only having one class when pretty much everybody else at the table, I personally had a single class fighter myself. But other than that, everybody else had multi-classed elves or something like that, of wizard thieves or fighter wizards or something like that. And among his disputes were they got two classes almost of the same level practically. They're only one level behind me, and as far as I can tell, that's really only making a difference of one top level spell. So we had kind of an ongoing conversation off the stream about, for people that aren't super familiar about how multi-classing worked in original D&D, about was that ever a good rule or not, or what are the counterbalances that you're currently not seeing to that?
I don't know that it's that different, frankly, from modern D&D. I was going over my fifth edition player's handbook and reading it, right? And of course they simplify it real straightforward of just, you have an XP chart per level that is completely, disconnected from class. And your total level is just the sum of the levels of your classes, the end. And so if you want to, when you raise a level, you can drop that in whatever class you want. The interesting thing is, I think that the problem is, especially in that kind of analysis, is that in a one-shot game, he's basically right. You know, in a one-shot game, yep. the pros and cons of multi-class really lean heavily towards the idea of multi-classing. And I feel like it's only really in campaign play that you get to feel why you might choose one direction or the other.
I agree. The balancing rules were, in original D&D, were clearly written with an idea to campaign play. And I totally agree that you and I continually kind of wrestle a little bit with our one-shots about setting up the characters around the issues of multi-classing, dual-classing. And I totally agree. It looks extra awkward in a one-shot like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And for in this particular case, we were playing at a level split where that one extra level wasn't significant, right? I think they were, right? He was maybe a level 6 wizard where everybody else was level 5. Mm-hmm. The difference between you, so it's that odd to even level split, right? Is like, okay, you get a few more, you get an extra spell or two, but you know, it's not unlocking a whole new level of spells. Usually when I run my one shots, I try to pitch it at a level where the single class wizard is going to be an odd level level. Right, mm-hmm. if he's an odd-numbered level, then that single-class wizard has a distinct advantage over any of the multi-classes. He's unlocked the next progression of spells that nobody else has.
Yes, I see that. Yep, I see that. Maybe just in case we have viewers that aren't familiar with the old versions, the elder versions of D&D, maybe we should just look at the XP tables from original D&D just for a second, just in case that's unclear what we're talking about. So this is original D&D 1974, and there's only three classes that are called Fighting Man, Magic User, and Cleric. And for people that have only played modern D&D, every class had its own XP table and advanced at a different rate. So the first one that I always think is kind of the baseline is the Fighting Man, the Fighters, where the XP goes 2,000, then 4, then 8, then 16, like that. The magic users broadly take more XP. There's a couple asterisks on that statement, but generally the magic users take more XP as they level up, and the clerics take less. And then in the next supplement, there's thieves that take even less than that, actually. So the classes weren't necessarily balanced. If you had a more powerful class, like, you know, presumably magic user, you'd balance that by making that class's XP table run slower than other classes. And if you did have multi-classing, then what you do is you'd have to keep track of two separate silos of XP. And maybe, like for elves, right out of the box in original D&D, you actually didn't have any choice about this. Your elves automatically had a fighter class and a magic user class, and you'd have to track the XP on two of these separate charts. And Paul, thank you for pulling that up.
Yeah, let's read the full text here, because I feel like it's so interesting, right? This is our first glimpse at multi-classing and how that works. And it's just like hidden in a block of text about what it means to be an elf, right? And that's the only place we get this information, right? And I'll just read it out here. It just says, elves can begin as either fighting men or magic users and freely switch class whenever they choose from adventure to adventure, but not during the course of a single game. Thus, they gain benefits of both classes and may use both weaponry and spells. They may use magic armor and still act as magic users. However, they may not progress beyond 4th level fighting man, nor 8th level magic user. Right, and then it gets into some other abilities of elves that are irrelevant to this conversation.
Yeah.
I find sentence like really confusing. They may switch freely. They may freely switch class whenever they choose. What the hell does that mean?
Right. There's the million-dollar question that every old-school D&D player has to wrestle with in that line. So 100% of us all find that at least somewhat confusing. I don't think I know anybody that reads that sentence and possibly argues that that's not at least a little bit confusing. Now, of course, we're at a point where the term, right, in this book, we haven't invented the term Dungeon Master yet. We haven't invented the word multiclassing yet. Right. So there's still, we haven't invented the term maximum hit points yet. So there's a lot of terminology that's still waiting to be developed in, you know, soon, hopefully. And so, this bit of the elves can switch class freely between these two options is at least the germ of the idea of multi-classing. So I've seen a number of different interpretations of that. You know, I try to read it as honestly as I can and try to make up something that I, you know, feels as close as I can. So how would you, as a knee-jerk reaction, interpret that, Paul?
Well, I guess I would lean into the secondary clause of from adventure to adventure, but not during the course of a single game, which I guess would mean when we sit down at the table, I got to look at the player who's playing an elf and say, are you a fighting man or a magic user this game?
Yeah.
Pick one.
Yeah. Right? But, and you know, if you read some stories by J.R.R. Holmes, right, who wrote who edited the first D&D Basic game, if you read his fiction, that's absolutely what happens. That's exactly what happens. And so the elf character has to decide whether they're wearing armor or not. They have to take their armor off to cast spells. But the next couple of sentences seem to deny that. It says classes. It says you can use both weaponry and spells. And it says you can use magic armor and still act as magic users. So it seems to hit. And of course, that was clarified in later editions. Of course, that was how it was run. So I tend to assume that that's how Gary and Dave intended it in the first place. So if I read the next two sentences, it seems to hit again and again and again that you can operate in both, even though it said not during the course of one single game.
But why say not in the course of one single game if that wasn't relevant? Maybe they're getting what they're getting at is how XP is awarded. I think that's how a lot of us have ended up interpreting that, right? That like your XP from this single game will go into one pool or the other, but not both.
Yeah. That's my best. That's my best embrace of that line. The closest I can get to making that rational is to say all the XP from one adventure all goes in one specific silo of your choice. And sometimes in the past, that's how I run it myself. In the past, I've asked that up front. I've actually said, okay, so in this session, player, tell me which class you're trying to train in. Which class are you trying to learn more about? And all the XP from this session is going to go in that one class and nothing else. That's the best. Or I ask at the end, depending on when I remember to do it. So that's actually how I run it, and that's the best I can do with that.
Yeah. It begs a lot of questions, though, right? Like, how do my hit points work? How do my saving throws work? Right?
Yes.
Like, do I have to track them separately for each class? What's going on? Also, it's fascinating, right, that it is chucked in here in the description of elves, right? It's literally the only one. We don't have thieves yet. So halflings and dwarves are just different variants of the fighting man, right? They're no different. They don't have any special multiclassing. This is our only multiclass in the OD&D is elves acting as both fighting man and magic user. Although I think, if I recall now, if I flip forward to Greyhawk, I'm going to find something that tells me something about thieves, right?
Yes.
About multiclassing the thieves, yeah.
Right. When you get to Greyhawk, I mean, basically it's the same as the advanced D&D rules. So you get a lot more detail. I think they actually call them multiclassing. You have thieves. It gives more detail about all the different mix-max possibilities of you could be fighter wizard, you could be fighter thief. You could be fighter thief wizard as an elf. You can be fighter thief or just a thief as a halfling. You have different level limits for all these combinations.
Yep. I find really interesting. I find it fascinating that we've kind of commingled all of these things by having the rules just show up under the description of the race. We now have like multiclassing is gated by your race choice, and that level limits are somehow part of it, right? And I feel like all three of those things are kind of separate things, and it's weird to me that they're all just jumbled together here.
I can see that.
If I look forward to the progression, like as we get into like fifth edition D&D, right? Multiclassing got nothing to do with your race choice, right? That is irrelevant. Right? There's no level cap. The level progression is totally disconnected from your race choice and your class choice.
True.
They are separate mechanics that live on their own. Frankly, these are cases where I think I would argue fifth edition has improved the system.
I am somewhat more comfortable with I've lived in this context forever, obviously. So the fact that, racial level limits were constant all through the early editions. There's an original D&D, they're in the supplements, they're in Moldvay Basic, they're in advanced D&D, makes me more less willing to change that element up. granted it was so consistent. And I'm somewhat more warm to the level limits, partly as, well, it's some kind of balancing to all the abilities that the non-humans get, and also as a world-building element, as a justification for why the humans are still dominant in the campaign world largely, and that it's not just run by a bunch of almost immortal, super-powered, high-level elves. Mm-hmm. I can imagine
that's,
people
and that's
wanting
the part of it. That's honestly one of the parts of it that strikes me as most discordant, right? Elves live so much longer than humans. Why? Why are they level capped in these classes? It doesn't make any sense at all. And it feels very gamey of just we needed a way to make these not the uber characters. So we put these arbitrary caps. It feels very arbitrary and foolish and does not make any sense to me in the world building sense at all.
Wow. Wow, how dare you, sir? How dare you? I am scandalized. I did not come here expecting for violence to be made upon the original D&D rules. So I'm a lot warmer to it. I find like if you're in like a Tolkien context, I can see this as the overall essence of the elves is waning over the years. I could imagine thousands of years ago that things were different. And maybe they're just unable to tap into the magic of the world like they were once upon a time. And I do see, you know, class levels as the most essential, you know, power of a character. And in other places, you know, once you get past first, second, third, fourth level, you're clearly superhuman. You're tapping into some kind of supernatural thing making this possible. So I don't know, maybe I'm just accustomed to it, but I'm a lot warmer.
Interesting. See, you read like a fighter leveling up past fourth level as them being supernaturally imbued with abilities. They are they're fighting, their ability to defeat people in combat, in physical combat, is not about training, but rather about magic.
I take, you know, that's in some of the rule books. That's in some of the advanced D&D rule books, where that's stated outright.
Interesting. I've never heard that take before. That is fascinating. I've always assumed it was more about training and skill and experience, right? They call them experience points. Your experience has taught you how to do better.
Yeah, I mean, they call it lots of stuff. I'm trying to find this on the fly.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm not asking you to defend it, Dan. This is a place where you and I differ, and we'll see this as we get to eventually when we get to the point where we're going to talk about how we have house ruled multi-classing in our own games. This is the key differentiator, I think, right here.
Here it comes, and you know, this is justification after the fact. You could say, look, the mechanics just don't make sense, and we're trying to come up with justification. So this is Advanced D&D First Edition Player's Handbook. This is Gary Gygax writing in the Player's Handbook under Character Hit Points on page 34, talking about, hey, a 10th level fighter could have as many as 85 hit points. This is the equivalent of like 18 hit dice for creatures, about what it would take to kill four huge war horses. It is ridiculous to assume that even a fantastic fighter can take that much punishment. The same holds true to a lesser extent for clerics, thieves, and the other classes. Thus, the majority of hit points are symbolic of combat skill, luck, bestowed by supernatural powers and magical forces.
Interesting. Luck bestowed by supernatural powers. Fascinating. I never thought of it that way.
Okay. Interesting.
Anyway.
I'm warm. Yeah. I'm warm to the level limits. It justifies the campaign world. If you have a different campaign in mind, feel free to change that up. It kind of makes sense to me in that with that justification. But maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm biased because I've had that in my head for some number of decades at this point.
I feel like it never comes out in play. Like I've never, like what you're talking about now, I've never felt like during play that I've seen, oh yes, the elves are limited in their access to supernatural ability to become super elven. I was going to say superhuman, but I guess super elven. right? That like just their access to the power of the world has been limited in some way. That's fascinating. So to me, it feels very gamey. The whole thing just feels like, I every time I read about racial level limits, I go, well, they decided, oh, we gave the elves and dwarves and halflings too many bonuses. How can we limit them? I don't know. Level cap. That's easy.
Okay.
Make them level cap. And I don't like that at all. So.
Okay.
So I'm going to use it. Fair. I'm going to use it.
Fair.
And interestingly, I will say, we're not the only ones who have debated this, Dan, because I feel like that this problem here that we're talking about, this contention around how this all works, this has got to be the origin of the race and class split in DX, right? I feel like Mulvey and Cook were wrestling with this. It doesn't make sense. We want to simplify. We want to make the game more approachable to people. Juggling race and class is confusing. You know, multi-classing is really confusing. Let's just make 7 character types. And elves are just their own special thing that are able to cast spells and wear armor, the end. And that's because they're an elf, and that's how elves work. We're done.
Clearly, that was the, you know, their intent was to simplify things, to edit things down.
From an organizational perspective, the thing that then bothers me is dwarves, right? If you look at, you enter a racist class world, and you go, okay, well, elves are the special, like, quasi-fighter magic user type, and halflings are the kind of quasi-thief fighter type. And dwarves are just a different kind of fighter.
Like, true. They're, agreed.
They're just odd. Yeah.
Interesting.
But then, like, you know, again, organizationally, I want to be like, well, then they should all be cleric fighters, I guess. But
oh,
that doesn't right. That doesn't right. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Yeah. Well, that's certainly Bilbo did not have 13. You know. Priests following them around, so
right
doesn't right. feel right to me.
Interesting. I don't think about those Moldvay simplified races class figures a whole lot. Now I will say that there was a point where years ago, where I was like, I love the Moldvay BX type rules. I'm going to stick with that. And they had a number of supplements. In fact, some of us were talking recently on our Discord server about they had this whole line of supplements called the PC line of like, you like those? Well, how about, you know, centaurs and fairies and pixies and everything, every monster under the sun. And it's a publishing opportunity because somebody has to write a brand new unique XP table with how they get their abilities as you advance as all these different quasi monster type. So they had a whole series of that. And we were just talking about PC2 was the supplement for aerial types. And it was a combination of this by Carl Sargent, this combination campaign setting of a giant floating city, as well as a bunch of new basic character types that were all flying in this flying city type thing. So I, at one point I was very enthusiastic about the opportunity, like make new classes and make new XP charts. And I'm going to have characters that are centaurs and fairies and stuff like that. Now I feel, you know, that's a little bit too elaborate. It's too much multiplying entities too much. And I do prefer having a relatively small number of classes that you're picking from that maybe you mix and match.
Possibly, Dan, the problem that we're going to approach here, especially as we talk multi-classing and the classes and how many classes are there, that we run into the just inherent problems in a class system, right? Like when, as we try to like apply, what kind of sense in a real world, so we try to apply like, you know, okay, we're modeling a fantastical real world model. And we just think about how humans advance their learning and their abilities and how they specialize or not in different skills. The class system really kind of falls apart, man. It doesn't work so well.
I get it. Now, some people are going to, and I totally agree with you, Paul. Some people are going to some of our very close friends are going to defend, right, race's class as archetypal, right? As in fantasy literature, you're one of these things. You're not a jack of all trades. You're one of these things. Yep. I can't quite get to that point. And for me, one of the things that's very telling is back in the day when TSR was publishing Dragon Magazine, and they had this series called Giants in the Earth, where they would take literary figures, and this went on for years and years, they take literary figures, stat them up in D&D terms. And this would include Conan and Fafnir the Grey Mouser and Elric and hundreds of other ones. they were almost had to be always multi-classed. Like inevitably, the vast majority of these figures, in order to describe them in D&D terms, you had to give them a mixture of some fighter and some thief and a little bit of magic user. And fighter and thief and maybe a little bit of bard and something else, like two or three or sometimes more classes to get those classic fictional figures to work properly in D&D. And obviously Conan is fighter with some thief, and so is Fafford, and Grey Mouser is thief with a little bit of magic user. And for me, that tells me that for the essence of even fantasy literature, you've got to have the multi-classing in play to give texture to your characters.
I had no idea the conversation was going to go in this direction, Dan, but this is like, this is the inherent problem in what is the intellectual property of Dungeons and Dragons. What is the setting, Dan? And fantasy is way too broad of a thing, right? I look at race as class, when I look at race as class and I put my brain into like a Tolkien mode, I go, this makes so much sense, right? Wizards are wizards. They're not men who studied magic. They're wizards. They're a whole separate thing.
Okay.
Right? Right? Okay. Right. Okay. If I read any Tolkien, right, I don't find a lot of like acolyte initiates starting to study magic in hopes of eventually becoming Gandalf. There's just Gandalf.
Okay.
Right? So they're just, wizards are this like separate class of entity. And I like that, right? So if I was going to play a Tolkien, highly Tolkien-influenced role-playing game, race as class makes a ton of sense to me. And then you're right, though. As we go, okay, but what if I want to play Fafford and the Grey Mouser? Well, okay, now the whole thing falls to pieces, because clearly the Grey Mouser is a tinkerer who's got no real formal, that's just like picked up little bits of magic here and there as he can. And I feel like that's the problem, right? Is you have a class-based system that is trying to define these archetypes of characters that is being applied to all fantasy literature ever, which is just never going to work.
Yeah. And look, okay, let's be perfectly honest. When they started out, right, and everybody that was at the original tables with Gary and Dave, they'll always say, we were just making it up on the fly. We didn't have any great big philosophy thesis about any of this stuff.
To
be perfectly honest, you can say, you know, there's some fighters in the world and there's some wizards in the world. So I guess those are two separate things. Very few later games went in exactly that same direction, like circa the 1980s. The broad consensus is that no game was ever going to use classes again. It didn't make sense. And we were talking, you know, skill trees and stuff like that. And look, I'm currently running a campaign in Star Frontiers. I ran a game Friday night. And it doesn't have classes, it has skills. You can mix and match. We talk about, like, I had a new player Friday night, and I said, what kind of college did you go to? Did you go to military school? Did you go to technical school? Right? And this is something that requires a lot less head scratching about what the fuck am I talking about? Sorry. This just kind of makes sense to people. And if you want to pick up a new weapon skill, or if you want to pick up first level medic if you need to, everybody can do that. It seems very, very reasonable, real world, and we'd never have any debates. You know, it's a simple system, but we never have any debates about what does this mean and what does this make sense. So, admittedly, starting off with the classes was something that we've inherited that was like, I don't know.
It's fascinating because, frankly, as I think of all the various other role-playing games that I've played, there are very few try to do it this way. Almost none, right? Unless you can tell that they're... let's say we want to talk about something, I don't know, like Tunnels and Trolls, which is clearly just aping D&D, right? Mostly either they're going to lean away from it and go more skill-based, more mix and match, just pick your powers, pick your abilities, pick whatever you want and customize the character that way. Yep. Or you end up with archetypal systems that are larger, where you have... Mm-hmm. Here's the 30 different archetypes for you to choose from.
Yeah.
Go, man, go, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Are you thinking like Quest there?
I'm thinking like Quest or Deadlands or, a lot of games usually. And again, and now they're not mixing matching, right? It's not like in Deadlands, I'm not choosing, do I want to be, you know, I don't know, what would I choose? Native American or colonizer? And then do I want to be a gunslinger or not? No, I'm choosing a gunslinger, or I'm choosing a shaman, or I'm choosing a, right? Like they lean into the tropes. They lean into the cowboy and Indians tropes, and they say, pick an archetype. Here are the dozen or two dozen, however many it is, archetypes.
Yeah.
Trying to think of like a lot of superhero games go this way, right? Either they're highly archetyped or they're all mix and match powers.
Yes. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, where would you put that? Are you stuck? Are you stuck on your starting class? Yeah.
Well, because there isn't classes, but there's careers.
Yeah.
And you're not stuck on it. You can advance through careers and you can switch careers. And there are probably a good 30, 40 careers or something stupid like that. There's a huge number of careers and they're high. Right. Again, I feel like most things, if they wanted to lean into like, no, there are archetypes and we're trying to portray an archetype, then they. No, they did what you. Now. The one thing I'll say is they did split, right? So there's a race in Warhammer Fantasy. You're picking your race, and it's standard fantasy races. Do I want to be human, elf, dwarf? But then from there, man, okay, here's this pool of careers, and you may get advanced careers and go through career progression, et cetera, et cetera. That might be the one that comes closest to bridging the gap to D&D.
Interesting.
And the class, careers, gate, what skills you get. Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Right.
Okay,
right.
Go on. Yep.
I want to talk. Okay, so I just want to talk like the history of this. So the level limits and the separate XP tables and the multi-class that we're talking about were constant part of mainline D&D all through advanced D&D up through original first, second edition, kablam. And then the notable big switch that basically looks like D&D does today came in third edition, like in 2000, is when they scrapped all the separate XP tables. You came up with one single unified XP table. And maybe if I'm sixth level, of those six levels, four might be fighter and two might be thief or something like that. And they took away the level limits. Okay. So no race has any level limits whatsoever. Okay, understood. You can freely mix and match. So you can literally mix any class with any other class, which wasn't the case previously. And then, but they're still trying to keep a little bit of the flavor about that. And with every race has what's called a preferred class. And what happens is that if your classes get out of sync, which is more than one level apart, you start accruing a 20% XP penalty from everything you earn.
The third edition does that?
It is. You see,
I don't think that exists.
So one thing, I agree with that. I don't think it does.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Okay.
But one thing that's happening in we were grappling with like how do you split up the XP for the elf, for example, original D&D. And my best take is for any particular session, the whole blob of XP has to go in either fighter or wizard. Not you can't split it up ad hoc. But what Gary did with the first supplement a year later was very different from that. And the rule that you get all through advance is that your XP is always split perfectly even between all your classes. You don't have any choice about it. So the levels will be about equal forever. And even if one of the classes hits the level limit, you're still dumping half your XP from the one class that's at the limit. So you're mandated to have basically the two classes at the same level all the time. So what happened in third edition is they kind of wanted to, it's not a requirement anymore, but they wanted to, kind of allude to that. So you're incented to have your levels equal, and then you have no penalty. If they get out of sync, then you start having a 20% penalty, unless one of them is your preferred class. So if I'm a dwarf and my fighter is out of sync, no problem, because you're just good at being a fighter. And then you're right, that element that was kind of thinking back to first edition, they got rid of that as of fifth.
Yep. And this goes down the, again, this is, okay, I'm going to say a bunch of things that are about my personal taste. I'm not saying that specific editions are better or worse than others, but the problem is, one, like, first of all, my eyes are almost glazing over with the level of complexity as you're explaining it. I'm like, oh, good God, so much. Don't want that. And then also, we see that complexity increase throughout across the board, right? We're getting more the classes, there are more classes, the classes have more abilities, there's more choices to make, there's more knobs for you to tune for your character. And now one of the new knobs I can now tune is, oh, a little splash of this, right? I'll take a level of cleric just to get, just to open the door to a heal spell, or I'll open, I'll take one level of fighter just to open the door to wearing armor, right? And this brings us in the direction of builds, right? Of now we're not trying to emulate the tropes of the fiction anymore at all. We're now just playing with game mechanics. And even if the game mechanics are better, more interesting, more exciting for me as a player to tinker with, oh boy, they're really robbing the backstory of the world, I think.
I agree with this. And that was a thing that, you know, was initiated in third edition, the way the rules were written. And the forms were all suddenly became full of character builds. Whole websites are written about that. And even this morning, I go to research something, and half of the hits that I get on Google are character builds and whatever, whatever. And I'm like, I personally was not a big fan of it. I'm a DM. I'm not a player. Maybe my perspective is skewed about that, but that was just kind of aggravating.
You sometimes play. You're not never a player.
Yeah, you're right.
So anyway, that whole thing just like quickly goes into not my taste. Dan, should we get into where we landed with our own house rules, since we're closing in towards the back half of this
episode? And I'll say, look, one thing that we agree about is that if you or I picked up Moldvay BX and we were going to play it, we would both backport in multiclassing. Am I remembering right about that?
Yep. Yeah, I eventually did. Now, I ran BX as is with Races class for quite a while. So I have some background in that. And frankly, I do like it. It is interesting. But then eventually I did get to the point where, like, yes, I wanted the race class, but I thought it opened more interesting doors.
Yeah, I agree. So I embrace multiclassing closely. I think for the texture, it's important. We haven't mentioned dual classing, right? So even again, in original D&D 74, there's also a rule that at least humans have the option to, just like elves, change class is what the term is at that point. Change class, pick up another class if they want to. I don't know why this has to be two separate rules. So as of advanced first, second edition, they had two separate bodies of rules. Of the non-humans, they called it multiclassing, and for the humans, they called it dual classing. I don't know why you need separate rules for this. That was not a good idea.
But why are any of these rules tied to your race choice? That's confusing. Go on.
just why you need separate sub chapters for these two things that seem like basically the same thing to me.
And dual classing, as I recall, is weird. And frankly, I remember back then, and even, you know, anytime I've sat down to try to play first or second edition AD&D, I've read it, I've tried to understand it, and I've discarded it. Have you ever played with it? Have you ever played a dual class character or played a game which had a dual class character?
I probably have briefly. It didn't make a big impact. To cut to the chase, I fold all those ideas into multiclassing. So I embrace the options, and I just call the whole damn thing multiclassing in my games.
There you go.
Yeah.
So when I do that,
okay.
do you want to dig into dual class as written, or are we just going to say
that's not yet? No, please, no. No mas. It's weird. We don't like it. It shouldn't. It's for multiple reasons. Don't look at that in first edition. So for me, in my games, humans can pick up multiple classes, and everybody else can too. You start with one. And then if you do have the option to pick up another class. Now, what I do, and I think this might be different from you, Paul, is that I do enforce the ability requirement that is in original D&D and first edition, second edition. So for the class that you're adding, and this is a fairly hefty requirement, you need an ability score of at least 16 in the prime requisite for that class. So if you're adding a fighter, you got to have at least a 16 strength to make that happen. If you're adding a thief and you didn't have it to begin with, you need at least a 16 dexterity to make that happen. So as a result of that, it's not commonly available. Most people aren't going to be able to do it. And the other thing that I learned in my last campaign is that that then becomes a really attractive goal for my players of, hey, I have a dexterity of 14 and I would love to add a thief class. Is there any magic in the world that I could go find to boost my dexterity up? And then that becomes a quest. And we did that a couple times, which generated interesting play. So I didn't mind that.
The attribute requirement is something I've tinkered with over the years. So I'm looking at, anybody who's read my blog knows I have a thing called the BXCL, the BX change list of all the house rules I was using in my BX campaign before I full-on switched to more OD&D. And according to this, you have to have 12 or higher in your prime rec to take a second class. Right. Now most what happened pragmatically in my campaign is that my players during character creation would probably plan this out. And they would go, well, eventually I want to switch. Mm-hmm. I would like to eventually be a fighter magic user. And since I have a very high strength, I'll start as magic user. That way I've got the prime rec requirement for my switch to fighter in the bag. Come to that later.
Yep. You could throw shade at that, but I'm okay. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the ability score requirement has come and gone, I think. So in the earliest D&D up through advanced, you need a 16 to get into it. Third edition wiped it out. There was no ability score requirements for any class. Fifth edition brought it back. So fifth edition 2014 brought back the need for ability minimums. If you're multiclassing, the limit there was generally 13. In what you were switching
in. But also, now, I don't know if that was brought in the standard progression of stat increases, right? So, like, there is a path for you to open these doors because
also third.
You get stat increases. Oh, also third has that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, third also has that. Yeah.
Well, at least they're a little less reliant on the, like, gosh, I hope I can find some magic to increase the stat.
This is a good point. This is a good point.
Maybe someday I can be a thief, right? And it's like, no, you can.
Yep. Yep. And that makes perfect sense. Yeah. I'm not sure if that was changed in 2024. So at least as of 2014, they have the 13 ability requirement. And I don't know whether that's still the true in 2024. Maybe someone could tell us in the chat. So interesting that came in, it went away, it came back. So that seems like kind of like borderline necessary for balancing that aspect of the game. And yeah, the other thing,
I never felt super strongly about it.
Yeah. I actually like it not having be completely willy-nilly. Like I don't want to see someone come in and go, I'm going to pick every single class by fourth level. Like apparently you can currently do. So I don't like that. I like it to be a little rare. I like the people that have multi-class can be a little bit exceptional. I don't have enough of a problem with that rule to get rid of it in original D&D.
Okay.
And the other thing that we both do is that we also feel there needs to be some kind of, you know, payment. So obviously with third or fifth edition, your one of your limited levels gets devoted to this class. So what, you know, in the past, what I did is I said, you need to sacrifice your top level. I actually have, my game has softened that. So what I actually have written down right now, is you have to pay 1,000 XP.
I guess it does all. So I've used the, you have to sacrifice your top level for forever. But you're right. The problem with that is it encourages this, like, well, I should multiclass soon, right? I should do it in the low levels because it's cheaper then. Yeah, I guess I do. I like the idea of it just costs a flat amount of XP. That's decent.
Yeah. And you can't do it right out of the gate. You gotta have one class get halfway through your first level, and then maybe you have the option of multitasking.
I assume, with the exception of elves, because I think one of the things that you and I both do is we give elves a free multi-class at character creation as a nod to the origin of where the heck multi-classing came from in the first place.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. Yeah, I feel like that's important. I feel like that's, if you're playing something and you're claiming to be original D&D, I think you have to have your elves be multi-class like that. Yeah.
Interesting. So, listen, let me talk a little bit about where I diverge a little bit. So, okay. I don't do level limits by race at all. It's totally gone from my game. Absolutely not. But what I do is actually implement level limit by class increment. So your first class, unlimited. Your second class, capped at 8.
Oh, yep.
Your
okay.
third class, capped at 4. And I like those numbers because roughly I kind of think that like the max level possible in any of my games is probably around 12. So so we've got these increments of 4, which is real nice. And if I again, if I think of like wizard as the most breaking, most interesting like thing, or we could also look at like fighters gaining feats or thieves getting extra levels of backstab. These prevent you from getting sort of the top tier stuff, right? If you're level capped at level 8 as a wizard, I think you're gonna maybe not see the level 5 spells, right? And yep. if you're level capped at 4 for your wizard, you're not gonna see your third level spell.
That feels really good to me, actually. What published rule set? I feel like some published rule set does the same thing. Does Swords and Wizardry do the same thing?
I have no idea. I thought I made it up.
I mean, multiple people, right? Multiple convergence or whatever we call that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Totally, yep. totally fair game. But I think I've seen that. Unless I'm just
I've
thinking of your house rules. Maybe just think of your house rules. Like, this is top notch. This is solid design work.
Yeah. So I like that. That is nice. The other thing that I hemmed and hawed. So when I came at again, if I'm looking at my BXCL, right? So I'm coming from BX and trying to introduce multiclassing into BX and put a race class split. Is I actually just put a straight up experience point penalty to the non-human races as a way of like, okay, I want to nod towards the fact that, frankly, if you look at the XP charts from BX, that dwarf and elf and halfling cost more to level up than the other classes. And so basically I just said like, yep, elves just need 20% more XP per level to go up, and dwarves and halflings need 10% more XP. Pragmatically, I would say I kind of shy away from that these days just because it is an extra level of annoying bookkeeping that does not make a huge impact. Even at 20%, which I'm kind of shocked by, that even at 20% turns out to be not that big of a deal, not that annoying, just annoying enough to like make me have to do extra math, which is why bother. Yeah.
I think that there's, you know, the geometric XP advancements that you have in original D&D. And I think in the earliest draft, the fighters went 1,000, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, doubling in each. And then for some reason, they doubled it late. They doubled everything later on to 2, 4, 8, 16, so forth. Maybe that wasn't a great idea. Again, you can just like, well, just double every time was probably somebody's, instinct to begin with. Later editions don't do that. So as of third edition, instead of a geometric increase, it's just a linear increase. So at least of third edition, you're adding 1,000 and then you're adding 2 more thousand, adding 3,000, adding 4,000 to get through the levels. And you could do some math and argue that that's a fundamentally a better idea for some reasons. But then when you are in this geometric XP situation, you wind up in the situation where minus 10% or minus 20% doesn't make much difference. You could almost just come in and say, just, I'm going to reduce it by half. And then you'll be one level back all the time.
Yeah. I don't think I need that because already I'm asking them to sacrifice a level in order to multi-class. And then by splitting their XP between two classes, they're advancing slower. So I feel like you already get this. You already get this for free.
Yeah.
And you're at 10%. Is nothing, right? It's all another reason why I don't use the prime requisite XP bonus. Because like, 10 whole percent XP for why? Like, it's just yay, more math for you to do. No thanks.
Yeah.
And one other thing I want to bring up that I think both you and I have toyed with, which I'm curious where you're at now, is the kind of use of armor. right? I think we've both in the past played with the concept that you can't cast spells in full plate. You can't use thief abilities in anything heavier than leather. Do you still do that?
I do.
Yeah.
I think it's common. I mean, okay, at least the thief point is common to all the early editions of D&D, so I'm happy to sail along in that direction. And I do think that in classic AD&D, elves casting spells in plate mail does seem not great. And if I look at a bunch of the campaign stuff that Gary wrote, inevitably he usually had, you know, even high level elves in chainmail instead. So the dark elves are casting spells and they're wearing magical chainmail all the time. The World of Greyhawk encounter tables have high level elven knights that are casting spells and in chainmail. So I feel like, you know, the campaign, the world building instinct was in that direction. And so I, as some kind of balancing factor, I'm happy to say can't cast magic spells in plate mail.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of feels like, you know, another reason for elven chain to exist in the first place, right? You know, it's interesting that the original text talks about how you can't cast magic in non-magical armor. I think, well, that's an interesting one. I've never played with that one. I'm kind of curious about that, although then that's opening the door for your fighter magic users to be running around in enchanted plate armor and casting spells. No big deal.
Bear in mind that for some reason, all through the first part of the original D&D player's book, Gary never mentioned any... Every time he mentions any armor or weapon, he always says magic armor, magic weapons. And he says clerics can use magic blunt weapons and fighters can use magic any weapons and magic users can only use magic daggers. And somehow he, for some reason, when he was writing those pages, he was hyper fixated on the magic stuff. My best interpretation is you've got to take that as that plus all the non-magic stuff too, is what his intent was. You know, magic users, we all play with magic users, you know, being able to use non-magic daggers, including the, as well as the magic ones that he literally referenced. You know,
Is your argument that the text here in OD&D is trying to say that elves can cast magic in any armor? Elves are more, right? Where does it say? They may use magic armor and still act as magic users.
Yeah,
I
do. Let's see. So now we're doing our textual analysis.
So it's kind of like two halves of a statement, right? You're saying like they can use magic armor. It's just like they can use magic armor. If, in case you were wondering if they can use armor or not, here you go. They can use magic armor. And then also they can still act as magic users while wearing armor.
I think like when he starts out talking about fighting men, it says fighting men, they can use only a very limited number of magical items of the non-weaponry variety, however. So he never literally says fighters, the very first line for fighters, literally the first thing that you say about fighters in D&D is the words, all magical weaponry is usable by fighters. Now, he never says all normal weaponry is available by fighters. He only says that for magical weaponry, but of course we all agree that fighters can use any normal weapon. So so in that same vein, I read the elven armor as saying you can use any armor.
Man, the wording of some of this stuff is so terrible.
Right? Right? That's slightly awkward, but that's my best what it says. Same for
I was kind of curious. I wanted to look up here. What does it say about magic users? Does it say that? And it literally says when we get to the equipment that they can use, it says the whole plethora of enchanted items lies at the magic user's beck and call, save the arms and armor of the fighter. See, however, elves. Magic users
clerics,
may arm themselves
right?
with daggers. Okay, well, there you go. Magic users may arm themselves with daggers only. At least there, we're not saying magic.
Well,
daggers.
You're right. Daggers. That's the one exception.
Yeah, and daggers. Yep.
It says of clerics, they have the use of magic armor and all non-edged magic weapons, right? Doesn't say anything at all about normal armor or weapons, but that's
super weird.
The only thing that makes sense.
Fascinating. Yep.
Right.
Oh, good.
Surprising. Gotta be careful.
We're out of time. Any
what happened? did I hit my level limit? Is that what happened?
you hit your podcasting level limit. Do you have any final thoughts to share on multiclassing or level limit?
Okay.
Or any other?
I like having a small number of classes with different XP tables. I like having multiclassing. I think it's actually very important for the texture of my games. And I still use level limits. I don't mind level limits. I think that the multi-classing, you know, problems that we have in our one-off games don't look quite as bad when you're more restricted in how you spend your XP. When like one session goes to one class, or maybe you divvy up half and half like you did in advanced D&D. And the other thing I'll say is that for the level limits, for me, my best solution, my campaigns, is that there's some kind of magic that the PCs can find to remove the level limits. And that's been part of our adventures and our quests. Not every character, right? All the NPC elves are running into this level limit, but there's some kind of special feature or magic item in the world that can increase your level limit if you go and find it. And that's worked pretty well for me to make sense of my campaign world and also give a little bit more flexibility to the player characters.
Yeah, we definitely differ of an opinion here. I'm not a fan of level limits as tied to race. It feels ham-fisted to me. But I do like to move that over to into the multi-classing realm. So again, tying your maximum level to your second class and your third class and being very restricted there. Yeah, but also I do like having a multi-classing. And I think there's something to it being tied to there being a small selection of races and classes. I think once one of those things grows too numerous, then, you know, we kind of lose hold of the thread. And then I'd rather, frankly, just go into like a skill-based system, honestly, or a power-based system or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I like, you know, from the old days, I like being able to identify your character fundamentally with like maybe two or three words, right? The rule of three. You know, if you have three classes, that seems about right. But when you get to a point where maybe you have four or five or six classes, like it seems like you're not even identifying your character as a thing anymore.
See that? Yep. So, yeah. So anyway, but by and large, I think we agree on a lot of points, and especially agree on how weird the OD&D language is around this stuff. Man, it is hard.
I mean,
what the hell they were trying
to figure it out. They were trying to figure out how to write it and how to play it and how to think it. And it is wild reading original D&D and seeing these just right at the inception kind of bawling infant in the world beginning of the game for us. And I'll say, Paul, I like your design. I like your solution to the multi-classing limit question. It's fundamentally a good design. I don't mind playing with myself.
Thank you. Yeah. I think I'm going to steal the idea of just putting a flat number of XP cost on taking a second class. I think that's wise.
Yeah.
I think that's more interesting than removes that weirdness of like you had better have a plan up front, right? Yeah, I don't want that. I would rather people be able to adapt as the campaign sees fit. But generally, also, I think that I think the multi-classing makes more sense, and these choices are more impactful in a campaign setting. That if you're letting your players do some kind of character creation for a one shot, it gets a little murky and weird. And so I'm not surprised that Max kind of hit a wall on some of that and went, "Oh, I made the wrong choice." And there was
Should spend some time thinking about, like, when we do our next one shot, maybe we should spend some advanced time to rationalize that and not run into that particular problem.
Yeah. It's generally also why I prefer to just play with pregens in my one shots, because I've thought about all this stuff and I've crafted the pregens intentionally.
Yeah. I see that.
Anyway, viewers, if you have opinions on multi-classing, dual classing, really angry with us for not having put more effort into defining dual classing and going over those details, or you have thoughts on the best way to handle multi-classing in your game, please leave a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you, and it may direct a future episode.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandrian DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and jumble up that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Files, the MP3 files for our podcast are available at our website at wanderingdms.com. This is where you can also find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, in about 10 minutes, we'll be there for our live video after chat, and we'll get to interact individually with everybody that shows up, which we adore every single week. You know, on a week like this, where we're very mano a mano in the show, there's a lot of really interesting chat flying by that that neither Paul or I had the bandwidth to inspect closely because we were trying to sharpen our arguments directed at the other host. So this is one of these days where I'm really looking forward to the after chat, and people can point me to the really important, really great ideas flying by in the chat that we didn't have time to pay attention to. So anybody that shows up there, we will love seeing you there at that point. And of course, don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.